You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 1st, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. How you all doing?
Good, Evan. How you doing?
Couldn't be better.
Doing fine.
Perry has the night off. He is feeling a little under the weather this week.
Feel better, Perry.
Feel better. He'll be joining us next week, I'm sure.
He's recharging his skeptical batteries, Steve.
That's right. That's right.
I actually went and saw him today.
Yeah.
How's he doing?
He wanted me to pass on a message that he's looking forward to coming back for next week. And
that doesn't sound like our Perry. Are you sure there wasn't like a curse word in there or something?
He actually he offered to still join us later on to give us the skeptical quote. But he's not feeling up to doing the whole show. Yeah.
Okay.
So we'll see. The first news item this week is about the infamous Death Cat. I think this gets the award for the news item about which we were sent the most emails.
Oh my God. I have never seen anything like it. Yeah.
We
got
funny.
Like dozens through the site. I got things through Skeptic. And then I also got to work that day and a coworker sent me. It's, hey, did you see this? I screamed. He cried.
So this is based upon a report that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which I think is partly responsible for why it was so widely distributed. Oscar the Cat, a cat living in a nursing home, is believed to have the uncanny ability of predicting when patients are about to die. The report indicates that he will, has a habit of lying in bed next to patients, and he will choose those that die within few hours.
That's a hungry cat.
The staff at the nursing home is so impressed with his abilities, in fact, that they have started calling family members to essentially tell them that, your loved one is about to kick it because, the cat is laying next to them.
Dr. Wrinkles says, your loved one's going to die.
Is that an ethical thing to do?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's fairly dubious. So, once again, the mainstream media fairly credulously reported the story. I mean, they love this kind of story because it's, it's interesting. It's kind of cute.
Yeah, and explain that, scientists.
Right, it's a little mysterious.
Let's give them a little credit, though. At least this one they did take from a reputable journal. Now, Steve, you probably read the New England Journal of Medicine more often than I do.
Right.
So maybe you could give us an idea. This was an essay that was in there, right? Which means, aren't most things in there peer-reviewed? And, they're actual studies.
This was not a study. It was not necessarily peer-reviewed. It was still, it has to get through the editors. And, the New England Journal of Medicine has a very high standard. And it also has an incredible reputation. I mean, this is arguably one of, if not the most prestigious medical journal. So I do think it was a mistake for them to print this. They probably were thinking this was, a cute human interest story. And we're not looking at it from the point of view of, are we lending credibility to maybe some dubious conclusions that were being drawn here? I do think, though, that the author, Dr. David Dosa, takes these claims seriously. My impression from reading the actual essay is that, he's convinced that there's a real phenomenon going on here.
Wow.
Now, I do think there's a phenomenon going on here. I think it's confirmation bias.
Yeah,
I think
really.
it's a really good example of confirmation
Absolutely.
Bias.
Well, the only thing I can think of, Steve, is it possible that, and this is going way out on a limb, but I'm just, is it possible that the cat can maybe smell something going on?
Well, they do have those dogs that can smell cancer, right? Maybe that's not real.
I don't know, actually. I haven't looked. The other one that was, I don't know about the dog smelling cancer. I haven't looked into that, so I can't really speak to it. But the other one that was brought up that was similar to this was the dogs predicting epilepsy.
Right.
I blogged about the epilepsy dogs and the death cat just because it was a nice title in my today. But the both are confirmation bias. Dogs, there's no evidence that they can predict when a seizure is about to happen. But Jay brings up a point, and I do think it's a little bit of putting the cart before the horse when you start speculating about mechanisms before you've proven that there's actually a phenomenon there. And I don't think it has been demonstrated. But in terms of trying to figure out, is there any plausibility to this, it is interesting. And, you know, I've seen some speculations that are not totally implausible, like perhaps, you know, metabolically when somebody is about to die, you know, there are things that can change metabolically in the body, and maybe, you know, they can get ketosis and their breath can become more sweet smelling and this might attract them. Or maybe the people are just not moving around as much. But these things, I don't know, I think that's pretty tenuous.
You know, the way I pictured it was, of course they're doing the bias, like you said, Steve. Like, they're really only recording the hits. They're sensationalizing it in their own minds. They want it to be true, so they...
Oscar's always right, except when he's wrong.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is the basic essence of confirmation bias.
And they even admit in the essay, the scientist doctor, he admits that they haven't actually tested this at all. They're right. still just, it's right. just basic observations. Unlike, say, the dog smelling cancer, which I just did a quick check, and I can't find anything that says that's total crap yet. But, you know, it actually, there was a scientific study done on it. So, I mean... With this cat, you think we can postulate all we want about, you know, maybe the cat is smelling death and whatnot. But it seems like first we should establish that there actually is something being observed here before
Absolutely.
We even bother figuring right. out why.
And, you know, I kind of dinged the New England Journal of Medicine in my blog by saying that, you know, this was an opportunity to teach the public about the nature of confirmation bias, and the flip side is the need for controlled scientific observations. This is why we need to do science, and we can't just make off-the-cuff observations because they will lead us astray. This was, I do also think that the science blogging community was all over this and pretty much correctly interpreted this from all angles, unlike the mainstream media. Some pointed out that this is exactly the same thing as the lunar effect in emergency rooms. You talk to ER right. staff, they all think that they're busier on full moons, mm-hmm. and they're not. When you do the controlled observations, they're not. I suspect the same will be true of Oscar. If anyone bothers to do a controlled observation, his visitations are probably random, or at least don't have any correlation to impending death.
It's funny to see, for example, MSNBC showing articles like this, or
this is good fluff, Jay. This is really good fluff. Plus, it is, as someone said, it is the New England Journal of Medicine. So, hey, you know, why
yeah,
not?
I think that's the most surprising thing.
Yeah,
it sounds to me like the letters to Penthouse at the beginning. Huh. Like, you'll never believe what happened to me, New England Journal of Medicine. I had this cat.
Was it a slow news month for the journal, or what?
I don't know.
We need some filler, quick.
They do not lack for submissions. That's not it.
Let's presume that the cat is actually doing this, which is very strange and amazingly unlikely. Why would the cat behaviorally want to do it?
I mean, I think the only hypothesis which would make sense is that there is something which is attracting the cat to these people.
Yeah. But from the articles, though, Steve, you get the idea that the cat is, you know, empathic.
Yeah, that this is the cat's doing this to lend comfort to those who are about to die. That's sort of the human interest angle that's put on it, which
but meanwhile, from what the article said, the cat is a bastard, you know, in between the deaths.
Right, the cat is aloof and doesn't like people.
Yeah, nobody actually likes the cat.
Right. Bob, maybe the cat actually enjoys observing death happen.
We need a pet psychic to know what the cat's really thinking.
Maybe the cat is sucking the breath, the life out of these people. Isn't that been proven?
Oh, 20 years ago in a movie.
Yeah.
I know. We can figure this out by just doing a CAT scan.
Oh my God.
Did you have to go there?
I had to say it. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, that would be more accurate than the general PET scan, right?
That's true, yeah.
I made that joke like 3 months ago. Come on.
That's right. Rebecca, all we do is recycle your funny bits because we can't come up with any on our own.
That joke is as old as the CAT scan.
Anyway,
the next news item, this is a quick follow-up to our interview that we did a few weeks ago with Orak, who talked about a potential cancer cure, DCA, which is not studied, not approved. It's a drug that might play a useful role as a cancer chemotherapeutic agent once it is studied, but it's being sold on various websites as a cancer cure. And Orak said he wasn't sure what was taking the FDA so long to shut it down, because this is a clear violation of the Food and Drug Administration rules. They were making claims that it cured cancer. So they were selling a drug with claims that it's curing a disease. And that is, unquestioningly a direct violation of regulations. Well, finally, the FDA did shut down the buydca.com website. There's a sister site, the dcasite.com, which is still up and running. And this is also interesting. Just reminds me of that this is a strategy that a lot of the snake oil salesmen employ, where they separate the marketing of their product from the claims they're making from the product. So there are two websites, one in which, the DCA site, where everyone makes all the claims about DCA and discusses it and says that it's curing their cancer. And that's a completely separate site from buydca.com, which is where you buy the product. And this is meant to give them, some distancing the marketing from the claims.
Yeah, but it's owned by the same people?
Yes, Jim Tassano owns both sites. He set up both sites specifically, for that purpose. So the freedom of speech sort of protects the website where it's just a forum for talking about DCA. But the other site is a commercial site selling a product, and that's the one that was shut down by the FDA. So it's about time. They definitely needed to do this.
Now, Steve, you said that there were no studies done, but weren't there some somewhat unrelated studies with children using this chemical in treatment of lactic acidosis? So,
I did not mean to imply there haven't been any studies with this at all. There are some studies with other indications, and there are also some basic science studies with DCA. But what there aren't are large controlled clinical trials of DCA in cancer.
Right.
And there certainly isn't enough to arrive at a conclusion, a scientific conclusion, that it's safe and effective for any particular type and stage of cancer. And it's all being sold as a big, again, big pharma conspiracy, because DCA can't be patented.
Right.
Leads some to the conspiracy mongering conclusion that, well, the big pharma can't make a lot of profit off of it, so they're trying to shut it down. When in fact, it's just about protecting the public from drugs that we don't have enough information to make good scientific medical recommendations about. There were two exorcism-related news items in the news this week. I don't know if this
cool.
is just a coincidence, randomness being clumpy and all, or if the one news item spawned, vigilance for other news items that were similar.
I think these things happen in threes.
Yes, numerology, I was going to suggest.
Right, that more confirmation bias. So the first one has to do with officers who responded to a report of an exorcism on a young girl. This was in Phoenix. When the officers got to the location, they found the grandfather essentially choking to death a 3-year-old girl, his granddaughter, while his 19-year-old daughter, and the mother of the child, sort of was looking on.
Naked and bloody.
Naked and bloody, right. So clearly a nasty situation was embarking. The grandfather was trying to cast demons out of this little girl by strangling her to death. The officers had to break their way into the room. When the first officer got in there, he hit the grandfather with a stun gun. He didn't go down. He had to hit him a second time. And I think a second officer had to get in there to actually disengage him from the 3-year-old in order to save her life. The grandfather eventually went down and appeared to be stable and okay at first, but soon afterwards probably had a heart attack. He coded, he fell unconscious, he had to be resuscitated, and he died on the way to the hospital, where he was eventually pronounced dead. So it's hard to say exactly what happened. It'll take a few weeks for an autopsy, for the autopsy results to become public. But, it seems pretty clear that the guy probably had a heart attack, that the stress of the entire situation, I'm sure, contributed significantly to it. The stun guns, they're relatively safe, but that also certainly could have contributed to
I wouldn't call them relatively safe. They've been I guess I should say upgraded from, they used to be called non-lethal. Now they're called semi-lethal.
Semi-lethal. Yeah, you're right. Because things like this can happen.
Anything is semi-lethal, actually.
Well, apparently this girl's family is semi-lethal, too, because they almost killed her.
Well, that's my point.
Right.
A moving car is semi-lethal.
I hate to see these stories. I mean, I don't know if it's a trend that exorcisms are getting so violent. I mean, there's always been this potential there.
See, this is what's funny, like the whole exorcism concept. But at some point in this in the grandfather's mind, he decided, I'm going to choke my grandchild to get the demons out of her. I'm going to mm-hmm. choke her. I'm going to put my hands around her throat and choke her. And I'm drawing a parallel between being crazy and believing in an extreme religion, because in essence, that guy was crazy when he was strangling her. He was not perceiving reality for what it was. He was,
from a certain perspective, that's true. I mean, he thought that this girl was possessed by demons and thought that choking them out of her was a good idea. But the question I always have in these cases is this somebody who has a mental illness or is reality challenged, has difficulty with reality to begin with, and then just seizes upon demonic possession and exorcism as a way of directing their kookiness?
Yeah, that's their focus.
Did the belief in demonic possession come first and drive them to this extreme mental state and these bizarre conclusions? Again, where, as you say, where he thought it was a good idea to choke his 3-year-old granddaughter.
Is there something somewhere in between where he's, you know, primed for this somehow? He's a little mentally off, and the religion comes in, and he seizes onto that, and it just sort of snowballs out of control.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It could be any combination of the two. It's not necessarily, you know, again, that false dichotomy of one extreme or the other. The other case is very similar. This is a man accused of beating a 14-year-old boy. In this case, however, the person conducting the exorcism was not a family member. This is 22-year-old Edward Uyesugi, who made contact with this family at the Cherry Hill Christian Center at a church, and convinced the family that this 14-year-old boy who has autism, that his autism was actually a consequence of demonic possession, and that he could be cured by exorcism. The family then let this, you know, the 22-year-old conduct the exorcism, which, again, it's one of these situations where over time it progressed to more and more violence until it got to the point where he was just beating the crap out of this 14-year-old boy, you know, to the point where finally the family objected. What happened was the family called the pastor. They didn't call the police. They called the pastor, to look for guidance. I mean, at least they had the sense at this point to say, something's not right here. Maybe we ought to check it out with our pastor. And the pastor did the right thing. He notified the authorities, who then came into the scene and put an end to it and arrested Uyesugi. So, but again, it's just incredible that things can get this, you know, out of control. And only, you know, in a situation where someone's mind is filled with such utter nonsense, where common sense is pushed aside.
It's medieval.
I'm not surprised, to be honest with you. I'm sure things like this go on all the time.
Imagine 500 years ago how things like this played out. I mean, it probably wasn't even a question. The kid has a demon or a devil in him. Who knows if that kid survived or not?
Well, there were no phones, so you couldn't call anybody, right?
What happened to the Highlander?
Or if you did, who did you call? You called 10 people who all said the same thing and said, yeah, that's a demon, so take care of it. And they took the boy out or whatever and stoned him to death.
The town would help you.
The lottery?
Right.
Lots of examples of things 500 years ago still, you know, creeping around in today's culture and society.
Steve, the second one, it happened in Indiana?
Bloomington, Indiana. Yep.
Hey, what do you say there, Sizzle Chess? This is Frank Rizzo. That's right, of the Jerky Boys. And if you don't want to fall for the old Hucklebuck, and you better listen to Steve on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. You got me, punk? All right, then.
Well, let's move on to your questions and emails. The first email is a correction to our discussion last week about Ward Churchill, who was fired for academic fraud, the investigation of which was spawned by his 9/11 comments. This email comes from Eric Eisenbarger from the U.S., who writes, I am usually in agreement with the panel on many topics, but I have to disagree with your assessment of Ward Churchill. In a speech at the University of Colorado, he had claimed he did not mean to portray the innocent victims, the janitors, and the passersby as little Eichmanns. My understanding of his claim was that the retaliation by the Middle East is in response to the United States foreign policy, which tends to mistreat people in countries who are not in agreement. Obviously, it is to destroy things and people, whether it is 9/11 or misadventures in Iraq, but the explanation that if we get people mad, they will want to retaliate makes some sense to me. I didn't interpret his essay as claiming that 9/11 was an inside job. Otherwise, I would dismiss that claim as nonsense. And Eric is correct in that the Ward Churchill never did claim that 9/11 was an inside job. He is not a 9/11 truther or a conspiracy theorist. He just thinks that the U.S.
asked for it.
He kind of has backed away from saying that the United States had it coming or quote unquote
deserved it.
You know, to get attacked. He specifically says he did not mean that, just that it was a consequence of the U.S.'s foreign policy. I still think, you know, that Churchill's, you know, assessment of the situation is pretty extreme. I don't agree with his characterization, that his analogy with the perpetrators of the Nazi Holocaust. But to be absolutely clear, not a 9/11 conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, thank you guys for all the letters. There's a lot of misinformation about Ward out there.
Yeah, he's a controversial figure, not unsurprisingly, and it does generate a lot of misinformation. But I think, you know, I've read as much as I could get on him since last week, just to see if there was anything, if he said anything that could be interpreted as a conspiracy theorist, and I couldn't find anything. The next email comes from another Eric Burns from Alberta, Canada, and he writes, "Hello, skeptic torchbearers. I am a fairly recent listener. I got turned on to your podcast after listening to Dr. Novella as a guest on Astronomy Cast. Needless to say, you are now in the top two of podcasts I listen to."
Cool.
Although, admittedly, I only listen to two. But you guys are awesome and a treat to listen to. Even Rebecca, who, for a grazer, can actually be pretty witty at times.
Although
not quite to the level of Perry. So Eric is obviously in the Perry camp.
Our backhanded compliment.
No one can really compete with Perry. It's okay.
Well, of course, we're all in his shadow, but that's easy.
I just ran across this today and thought I'd run it past you guys, as it seems to be right up Dr. Novella's alley in particular. It sounds more than a little bizarre and suspicious. I find it quite difficult to believe that a human being with, by an account, up to only 25% of a brain can live a healthy life. The article seems fairly well written and at least gives somewhat of a sense of credibility. Thanks for your time and keep up the great work. Well, we have the link, and it's to a case of the so-called man with no brain, or man with a quote-unquote tiny brain. This is actually nothing new to neuroscience. Basically, what you have is someone who has an extreme case of hydrocephalus. So in the middle of the brain, there's several chambers that are filled with cerebrospinal fluid, CSF. And in some people, that can expand either because there's an obstruction or for other reasons. So, and there are cases that crop up every now and then where we see people who have what looks like if you do an MRI or a CAT scan of their brain, you see just a thin ribbon of cortex around the outside of the cranial cavity. Inside that is just hugely expanded CSF spaces. So, you know, at first glance, it looks like they have almost no brain, you know, when you look at the imaging. But really, there's this thin, you know, ribbon of cortex. And it's very impressive looking. And it's impressive that somebody could be awake and, you know, walking and talking and functioning with such a small ribbon of brain. But you know, when you actually investigate it a little bit more deeply, it's not as impressive as it may at first appear. And there is certainly nothing mysterious about it. In these cases, this is usually a congenital problem, so it was present, you know, since birth or very soon after birth, and it's something that develops slowly. That develops slowly over time. The brain is also it's very plastic, and it's also very malleable. It has the consistency of Jell-O, and it can basically just move out of the way of anything that's pushing on it, and it can contort itself to fit into whatever space it has to fit into.
Well, look at some of those cultures, Steve, that bound people's heads as an infant and produced incredibly bizarrely shaped heads. And,
exactly.
Of course, they had no deficits because the brain just kind of squeezed into the shape that was there for it and with no problems. So,
like a bonsai baby.
But, Steve, how big is the guy's brain? Like, if you were to blow a balloon up, and how much of that balloon could you cut away and say that's how much brain mass he has?
It's hard to put it in those terms. It's because it's not that it's being taken away. It's just that it's being squished up against the inside of the balloon, right? The other thing is that the number of neurons and the connections and the pathways can all also be relatively preserved, even though they're kind of being squashed together. And I've seen this, you know, as long as it happens slowly enough over a long enough period
right.
of time, it's remarkable how much the brain can be squashed into different, you know, smaller spaces and still function. I had a case myself where someone had the front half of his head filled with a tumor that probably took about 15 to 20 years to grow.
Wow.
And had some deficits because of that, but was very high functioning. Most of his brain functioned just fine. And when we took the tumor out, his brain expanded back out to fill the rest of the skull, and he was fine.
So, like, if you have a stress ball.
Like one of those
ball,
squishy stress balls.
Yeah, yeah. Shaped like a brain.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Hmm. I actually have one.
Shaped like a brain?
Yeah.
One more quick email. This one comes from Bob Calder, who writes, "If this is interesting to you, it might provide a distraction from the otherwise tedious creationists. The description reminds me of some of Yamatrandrian's descriptions of temporal lobe disturbances." And he gives a link to a Live Science article about the overview effect. Have any of you guys heard of this yet?
Sure.
This reminds me a lot of The Secret, you know, the overview effect. It's in that it's just a bunch of spiritual nonsense, you know, kind of new age, transcendental kind of stuff. The story is that many of the Apollo astronauts or other astronauts who were in orbit and had an opportunity to see the entire Earth at once had a profound emotional response to that. Where
should have sent a poet and all
actually
that.
Actually, can only see half of it at once, Steve.
You're right. Thank you, Jay. But the image of the Earth, you know, in front of them, it was just a profoundly emotional experience, and many said, you know, it really makes you realize that we are all living on this same planet. So it's kind of an existential experience.
Yeah, but that's perfectly understandable.
Well, what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that, but it's what they extrapolate from that there's an actual collective unconscious, you know,
oh, something gets released.
Actual, yes, yeah, some actual, you know, experience is that something is actually happening other than just an emotional reaction to this experience. They also, you know, conflate this with the report of Ed Mitchell, who had a more of a profound experience, and he writes, "And then, without warning, an overwhelming feeling of bliss, timelessness, connectedness. He suddenly and deeply felt the understanding of his constituent atoms and having been born in the fires of ancient supernovas. He saw Earth and its people and all its other species and systems as a unified, integrated, synergistic whole. He felt good, ecstatic, actually."
That's not a quote, is it?
That's somebody describing how he described his experience. This is in the article on Live Science that was being linked to by Dave Brody. That's not what everyone experienced. That actually sounds like a neurological event to me, not a spiritual event.
Really, Steve? Or could a neurological event be triggered by something as profound as that?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, just the emotional experience, I don't think so. I mean, that is that sense of being one with the universe, of a very profound connection to everything, is a well-described neurological phenomenon.
That sounds like an orgasm.
That can happen. It actually, you know, it's interesting that you say that, Evan, because that is a little component of an orgasm, is that you do have that experience. And it may be why there is a part of the brain that produces that experience. But if you have, say, a seizure of that part of the brain, then you get the full effect, which sounds like what he's describing.
It sounds like the best seizure ever.
Steve, yeah. You know, to counter you, though, real quickly, I think that it would be strange if you were in that position. I think it would actually be strange not to have a profound experience.
I agree with you.
I agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. So what I'm saying is that most of the astronauts have a profound emotional experience. That's perfectly normal. It's perfectly, you know, reasonable. But, you know, this author, David Brody, who's writing about this overview effect, is saying that's the same thing that Ed Mitchell experienced with that more dramatic description, which actually sounds something like either the kind of derealization that can happen during a seizure or even during a panic attack, since you bring up that as a possibility. Or maybe the oxygen was turned down a little bit too low on a spacesuit. Who knows? I mean, you can get that. That's kind of like also the narcosis of the deep that you can get.
What's the style do?
So who knows? Who knows what happened at that point in time? But now they're trying to extrapolate from all of this to say that there is this galactic, you know, universal consciousness that's trying to speak to us and trying to show us the underlying reality of things, and that but people only can get connected to this when they're in outer space. And what they're trying to do, and they call this the overview effect, what they're trying to do is figure out how can we get people to have the same experience while while they're still on Earth, so we can get everybody, so we can get everybody to realize, have this epiphany that, that we're all connected.
I know how we can reproduce it, but I don't think the results are going to be desired.
How do you do that?
Well, you need a little bit of fairy cake, and you create the total perspective vortex, but unfortunately, you go mad and die.
Right. Right. Yeah, this is kind of like the total perspective vortex.
Bob, that's out of our budget. We can't swing that.
One last comment. The author writes that after decades of studying this, Ed Mitchell is pretty certain that the feeling of interconnectedness, oneness with the universe, is a consequence of quantum physics.
Oh, of course.
There it is.
It's quantum physics.
Nope, it's neurology. Sorry to say that. Well, we have an excellent interview coming up with Barry Glassner, and we also have a little surprise, the return of Randy Speaks.
Woohoo!
After the interview. So let's go on to our interview now. Joining us now is Dr. Barry Glassner. Barry, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for inviting me.
Barry is a professor of sociology at the University of Southern California, and he has written two books that we want to talk to him about tonight. The first is The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things, and also his newer book, The Gospel of Food. But let's first talk about the culture of fear, and I guess I'll start with the obvious question. Why are Americans afraid of the wrong things?
Well, I think that there are a lot of groups and organizations that profit off of making us fearful or keeping us fearful. So at the top of that list, in my mind, would be local TV news. And pretty much anywhere in the U.S., if you turn on a local TV news broadcast, you'll hear frightening stories about your local community and the nation and the world. The motto at local TV news stations is, if it bleeds, it leads. So even when crime rates, for example, have gone down or are decreasing, there'll be all kinds of scary crime stories on local TV news. And then if you move on from there, politicians of all sorts benefit from fear-mongering. Many a politician has won an election by essentially suggesting that the less safe or downright unsafe if the candidate's opponent were to win. And then when you go beyond those, there are lots of companies marketing all sorts of products, from burglar alarms and home alarms, based on scare tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, I think advocacy groups are very important in this, especially in some areas. So many of their solicitations, whether it be with regard to a particular disease that they're trying to combat, or many of these, of course, are political groups, the solicitations are often based on fear, because that motivates people to take out their wallets and write their checks.
So you're saying that the primary factor is that there are vested interests who are selling fear because it serves their purposes.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that there are a wide variety of them, with so many so active and fear-mongering so profitable, not only economically in some cases, but politically and otherwise as well. There's just a lot of fear and scares in the air.
Do you think that another factor is human psychology? Do you think this is just part of the way we're hardwired?
Well, we certainly are hardwired to react to frightening messages and frightening images, but I think any explanation that focuses us primarily in that direction is going to miss the point, because without the message or without the stimulus, if you will, you're not going to get the response. A variation on that, for instance, is when of that argument is heard a lot from people who are engaged in fear-mongering. So, you know, when you talk to producers of TV news, they'll say, we do this because it's what the public wants. How do we know that the public wants it? Our ratings go up when we do these kinds of stories. Each piece of that is a non sequitur.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, there's no public clamoring for these. But they are certainly tapping into what you're alluding to, that we have an immediate response. The more sophisticated they are at that, the better they do.
So it works from the point of view that it does drive ratings and people do get elected. You acknowledge that that's the feedback that's driving this.
These campaigns are typically quite successful. That's right. And if they weren't, they probably would be discontinued. But yeah, they tend to work pretty well. Obviously, some groups and some individuals and organizations are much better at this than others. But if you make use of a widespread concern or fear, you're likely to be pretty successful in these approaches.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that it's like the lowest common denominator of the media in a free society. It tends to do the easy things, the things that are effective in the short term. And so things tend to devolve, if you will, in this direction over time. Is that the broader, you know, sociological, you know, pattern that you see?
I think that, like any individual or any organization, you know, you want to get as far as you can on as little energy as possible, right?
Right.
And fear is an effective way to do that. You know, then we have to ask what safeguards are in place for this sort of thing. So if we talk about in journalism, for instance, the sort of safeguard in a society that has a free press that ought to be in place at a minimum would be journalistic ethics, if not outright supervision either by a professional organization or group of organizations or from those bodies that license the airwaves in the case of broadcast. At various periods and in various places, those countervailing forces have been pretty strong. But typically, in a very competitive market, media market, like, say, cable TV news, that's not going to be the case.
So even if they want to do the right thing, you think the temptation is just too much, you know, in a competitive market?
Oh, I think it's very tempting, and it's very expedient as well.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of what I'm interested in is why is it that low probability risks or dangers are blown way out of proportion at the same time that higher probability and sometimes very high probability dangers get almost no attention. And there are a lot of answers to that that I write about, but one big part of it is that it tends to be more expensive in terms of time, money, expertise, variety of things, to deal with these higher probability dangers. Take TV news coverage. If you want to cover, say, the healthcare crisis in the U.S. or problems with public schools in the U.S., which affect a tremendous number of children, or even something very simple like accidents to children, covering any of those is going to be much more difficult than doing a frightening story about, say, strangers kidnapping children off of school playgrounds. Now, the latter almost never happens. It's about the last thing that a parent should worry about. But it's easy to make a great story about that, whereas it's, a really compelling story, right? But it's very difficult to do a story about any of those other topics that I talked about. You would need a lot of time, you need a lot of expertise, it's much more expensive, it's much harder to keep the audience's interest at the same level. So it, in many regards, it's more expensive.
Right, so again, it's the same basic forces that the intellectually high energy states of quality journalism, you know, takes more activation energy, takes more energy to maintain it, and therefore things just tend to degrade to the low energy state of the quick, easy, sexy fear-mongering.
Right, and you know, if you think about politics, right, and it's the same sort of phenomenon. And if you're in an environment like we are, in certainly in the U.S. and in most parts of the world these days, political campaigns are mostly conducted in sound bites, and that's the only option that the candidates have. And so, in addition to the phenomenon we've been talking about, you've also just got a very rigid kind of structure that you have to fit your message into. And to do that in a way that motivates people to act in the way that you want them to act, which is typically to vote for you. You got to get their attention and get them to move on it. And fear's a very good way to make that happen.
Barry, another example of people overemphasizing low probability risks that we like to talk about is people's inherent poor facility with statistics. How much of a factor do you think that is?
I think that's a really serious factor, and it's very widespread. And I think that we could go a long way just if people, if sort of the general public could learn a few simple lessons, like the difference between absolute numbers and percentages, would go a long way. And how mm-hmm. and how you reason with those. In fact, a lot of what I've looked at really. I don't know about a lot, but a fair number come down to that, where it can sound, for example, terrifying to say in one circumstance 1,000 people were affected by this thing. Well, if it's 1,000 out of 80 million or 300 million or 250 million, it's not clear that's quite as frightening as it first sounded. And the other way around, if you hear that there's a 30% increase risk to you from doing something, like eating a particular sort of diet, that can sound really, really frightening until you put that in some sort of, unless you can make some sort of sense of that. So, for example, the increased risk of lung cancer from smoking, depending on which study you believe, somewhere around 2,000 to 3,000%. So even if a study is correct in saying that you have a 20 to 30% increased risk of cancer from a particular sort of diet, you can see how relatively insignificant that is compared to a substantial risk from another kind of behavior, like smoking. And moreover, in any of these cases, if you don't know how many people we're talking about in a sample, you don't really know what to make of it. So if one person misreports their behavior, and that results in whatever percentage change, that's a lot less meaningful, typically, than if you have a large sample and a really well-constructed sample.
Right, yeah, that comes up a lot, the difference between absolute risk versus relative risk, and you could kind of choose which one you want to report on to either, emphasize or de-emphasize a risk. And the other point that you're making is that the absolute numbers will tell you how reliable the numbers are. I remember the case that reminds me of is the increased ALS cases among Gulf War veterans.
Right.
It sounded like there was a statistically dramatic increase in the risk, but it was such a few number of people that just one anomalous case really could have accounted for the numbers. And so that's not really reliable epidemiologically.
That's right. You can find that in a lot of these instances is what I find. And by the way, from well-intentioned people, mm-hmm. it's not necessarily just people who are trying to sort of build something out of proportion.
In your experience, what are some of the most interesting or dramatic misplaced fears that Americans have today?
Well, I think the biggest ones at any point are whichever ones are being promoted at the moment by a combination of the media and politicians and advocacy groups. And that varies from time to time. So, sometimes it's shark attacks. Sometimes it's kidnapped children. Oftentimes it has something to do with some minority group lately that tends to be Latino or Hispanic immigrants in the U.S. For a long time and periodically there will be scares blown way out of proportion about African American men. That recurs over and over again. Now, obviously, in recent years, there's been a lot of fear-mongering also about sort of nameless and faceless terrorists who are perceived to be from the Middle East and Arab origin. How one wants to assess that risk, we could debate, but the danger to Americans so far, in terms of what's knowable in the U.S., is pretty small. That's not to suggest that it's not something that people should worry about in various ways, but probably not in the ways that is being promoted. And again, that's I'm a bipartisan critic of fear-mongering. I don't think either party, for instance, or the left or the right is better on this. A big point I make in the book is that during the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton was as much engaged in fear-mongering as any Republican president prior to that time, and now I would say also subsequent to that time. Took different form and had different targets, but he was very, very good at it.
Yeah, and that does bring up the point also of how do we balance a preparedness and not being overwhelmed by irrational fears.
Well, one difficulty here is what are you preparing for?
Right.
And to the extent that we prepare less for more, spend less and are less well prepared for higher probability risks, we put ourselves at greater danger, right?
Right.
So even if one believes, for instance, that there's a huge danger from international terrorism at an individual or local level, you'd be much better off to invest in local health care, for instance, or in local health care facilities, because even if you're right about the terrorist threat, you're going to need those, and in the meantime, you need them on a day-to-day basis. You know, at a family level, I find myself constantly distressed to see the sorts of things that people will spend their time and money on in their households because of fears that they have, you know, buying all kinds of car alarms and home alarms and all kinds of complicated equipment for their children and so forth, when they, you know, haven't bought the children bicycle helmets.
Right.
Or even worse, I mean, when I walk through a house where, you know, I see a carpet that's where there's a reasonable chance that it's going to slip and somebody's going to be hurt, it's astounding to me. The one in many communities that's probably easiest for people to see in this regard is drunk driving, which is clearly among the very greatest risks to teenagers in most communities in the U.S., and we pay relatively little attention to it. You know, and by that I mean, you know, you're not going to find politicians running on this. You're not going to find city governments doing much about it. You're certainly not going to turn on your evening news and see a story about it. Instead, you'll see some very unlikely thing, you know, like the murder of the day.
It seems that we do focus on dramatic risks more than the statistically probable risks. Like sharks, shark attacks are sexy, bee stings not so much. So, you know, we worry more about something that's likely not to happen, and we ignore something that is actually the greatest cause of animal-induced deaths in the world, you know, bee stings. Do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, again, about the sort of the interplay between the sociological factors and human nature?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that is the case. You know, basically what's happening is that these organizations and businesses and politicians and so forth are working off of that fact, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so then it seems to me the question is, what are the alternatives? And I don't think that they're as narrow as one might suggest. Okay, so, you know, you can have very exciting news stories, for instance, on high probability dangers.
No, I agree. And we run into this, too, with reporting science. You know, it takes a little bit more effort to report real science, but pseudoscience is easy, sexy, cheap, low-energy kind of thing to present. So I think it's a very, very – there's a lot of analogy there to draw.
Right. I think that's exactly right. As you may know, you know, I'm very involved in skeptic organizations and very committed in my own way, too. And I make those connections, too, not as much in my books because I try to stick to what I really – I'm focusing on at the moment, but it's occurred to me often, you know, when I see the Bigfoot stories and the UFO stories and all that sort of stuff, they're not really very different than the stranger danger stories that I write a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they have pretty much the same motifs, right?
Right.
It's this unseen person, and it's important that they're unseen, right? Because they're never going to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
You see, in both cases, that we describe in ways that are familiar because they've been retold so many times. And that in itself makes them scarier. So, you know, another part of this phenomenon that we haven't really discussed is the familiarity that breeds a kind of comfort in these stories. And, you know, so I think, you know, these kind of familiar but really off-base stories are both easier, as we're saying, And also in an odd way, kind of comforting for the audience.
I want to turn to your other book, The Gospel of Food. And there's a very similar message, you know, thematically in this book, which is essentially that the information that the public is being given about the nature of food, the obesity, what's causing it, is similarly distorted. Can you give us a synopsis of that?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the biggest fallacy here is this notion that foods are inherently good or bad. And people get, I think it's fascinating both that Americans seem so prone to this way of thinking, and also how well food marketers, both from the food industry and also from nutrition advocacy groups and so forth, just how effective they are at making use of that. And when you really look at particular foods and food groups, that it doesn't hold up particularly well. When you look at explanations for particular outcomes, you mentioned the obesity epidemic. What fascinated me is that the common explanations are at once incomplete, if not outright inaccurate, and a lot less interesting, at least to me, than some of the actual explanations, some of what the evidence more clearly shows. So, for instance, a whole variety of people have blamed the fast food industry for America's weight gain, but the timeline doesn't work when you actually look at it. The people who argue this, including people who I think do very good work in other cases, like Eric Schlosser, like to say that the proportion of fat Americans soared during the same period as the rise of the fast food industry. And in fact, that's not the case. It was in 1966 that the signs outside of McDonald's read over 2 billion sold with a B. And by the mid-70s, McDonald's was a billion-dollar a year industry. There were at least 20,000 locations of McDonald's and their rival firms. But obesity rates barely budged during the 60s and 70s. It was later that this happened. And there are a whole variety of these sorts of seemingly self-evident explanations that don't actually hold up, which is what you find in lots of areas of the social world, the natural world, and so we shouldn't be that surprised. But in this case, some of the research in a variety of places, I talk about not just the sociological in my book about this, but I go quite far beyond that. But just to take a sociological element here, one important factor is clearly the anti-smoking campaigns that were so successful during this period. There's a lot of evidence for this. And in fact, if you want to look for parallel timelines, during the period that weight rose, shot up, the number of smokers declined significantly. In the 1980s and 90s in the U.S., declined by about a third, and when people give up smoking, they typically gain 10 to 20 pounds. So, you know, this is what we usually call the law of unintended consequences. Anti-smoking campaigns are a very good thing, and you get some unintended consequences from them. Now, there's a lot more to the story of America's weight gain than the success of anti-smoking campaigns. But it's an interesting and important factor, it seems to me.
So you think that maybe we should let people go back to smoking in restaurants but not worry about that trans fat ban?
No, actually, it's hard for me to imagine any greater public health hazard at the individual level, you know, that comes from and affects individuals than smoking.
Yeah.
It's such a serious danger in so many ways. That we could spend a whole program on just all the dangers from smoking. So no, I think that protecting folks who don't want to expose themselves to cigarette smoke is a good thing to do. Protecting them, you raised the other one. Protecting people from trans fats is much more dubious.
I thought it was interesting in your book that you drew a strong correlation between obesity and stress or anxiety.
That's right, and that was something that was really interesting to me as well. That came out of a lot of interviews with people far outside my immediate field who have researched this at the physiological and biochemical levels, and I think the evidence is pretty clear. Now, where that matters in a kind of community or social sense, is that it helps explain why there is, in general, an inverse correlation these days between income and obesity rates. It's not perfect, but it certainly is the case that poor people are much more likely to be obese. And the types of stress that they confront are precisely the sorts that result in this. And I explain that in some detail in the book.
Barry, you also believe that obesity is not related, as many people think. It's not related to eating too much and lack of exercise then.
Yeah, actually, I don't go that far. But what I do say is that there is a substantial body of evidence of research showing that kind of nice, neat explanation. Calories in, calories out is how it's sometimes referred, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of reason to believe that at a minimum, it's much more complicated than that. And probably doesn't hold up terribly well. You know, for example, there's research showing that there are people who eat quite a bit and don't gain very much. Others who gain weight when they eat relatively little. We sociologists are not noted for arguing for genetic explanations over social explanations. My own view is that if you don't look at all the dimensions, or all the causal factors, you're just blinding yourself. And in the case of obesity, there's no question that there's a heavy genetic component. But, you know, we want to blame people and blame specific diets instead of facing up to that and seeing what we can learn from that.
Yeah, there's no question there's a huge genetic component. But for an individual, you know, once you have your set point or whatever for uh-huh. your personal genetics, if an individual changes that much, the amount of food calories that they take in without increasing the amount that they burn off or whatever, if they change that equation, that does lead to weight gain or to weight loss. I mean, I don't think you're suggesting that that's not the case, right?
No, just how much.
You can certainly have an effect on your weight.
Yeah.
I know that apparently there are some people who argue otherwise. I'm not among them. But to say that isn't to say very much, right? Because,
yeah.
You know, then we have to ask how much change can you make at what cost and to what end?
Mm-hmm.
And I think those questions are not answered very well in the research at this point. And certainly, you know, the typical kind of argument that you see, you know, from so-called health columnists and others, and is really very misleading. You know, the notion that, you know, you can just decide that you're going to be a very different weight, it isn't the case for most people. And there's just tremendous evidence suggesting that.
I agree, though, and you're probably aware there was just a recent study that strongly correlated obesity with socialization, with your social circle.
Yeah, that's a really important study. That's right. It has, you know, as with all research, you know, there are questions to be asked about it. Having said that, it was very well constructed. It was a very strong study. And it's not alone. And also, by the way, going beyond that, you know, there's considerable evidence for factors that are hardly ever discussed, like environmental, and by that I mean the natural environment, and pollution effects. But, you know, to get into all that, we'd have to have a very different framework than we have in our public discourse on this.
My sense is that, you know, there are certain things you could say about, you know, obesity and weight gain and weight loss on an individual level, but if you want to have an impact on a societal level as a public health measure, you have to take this sociological approach to it and not just, you know, try to treat it on an individual level.
Well, that's right. And also not preach to people this kind of simplistic message that isn't accurate. I talk about a group of studies in here that were in my book, in The Gospel of Food, that was summarized really by this research group who basically concluded that dieting to control weight is not only ineffective for many people, but it actually promotes weight gain for substantial numbers of people. And so, you know, then where do we go from there? And one thing I argue is let's start by not blaming specific foods for specific diets as much as we have done.
Yep. Oh, yeah, we actually totally agree with you. Whenever this comes up, I mean, that's a basic point that we make, that dieting doesn't work. And the data increasingly shows that, if anything, it's counterproductive. And blaming food is also counterproductive.
That's absolutely right. For some people, it does, like with anything else, and that's probably because they have a different genetic profile, although we don't absolutely know that. But by and large, as you know, on a population basis, what you just said is absolutely the case.
Well, Barry, thank you very much for being on the Skeptic's Guide. It was a very informative interview. We really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for inviting me.
All right.
Thanks, Barry.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. Bye-bye.
And now, Randy speaks.
I am now speaking with James Randi. Randy, thanks for talking to me today.
Great pleasure.
Now, as many of our listeners know, Randy has been gracious enough to contribute a regular segment to the Skeptic's Guide called Randy Speaks, although that segment has been on hiatus for a number of reasons. Events have conspired to foil our attempts to get him back on TAM5, the aftermath of that, then Randy, you were traveling quite a bit, and then there were some technical difficulties. But now we have come up with a solution. We're going to have a slight format change to Randy Speaks. One of the rogues, today it's me, will be interviewing Randy just to briefly ask him questions, and then we'll be recording the episode more like an interview. So that solved all of our technical problems. So, Randy, the question I have for you this week is this. You have a long experience being interviewed on television, making TV appearances. You've met a lot of TV stars and famous people, and I've heard you tell a lot of stories about interesting encounters with some of those people. Is there anything that sticks out in your memory, any encounter with a famous TV personality who was particularly gullible, let us say, or lacked certain skeptical skills that comes to mind?
No. Next question. As a matter of fact, I was disappointed. I did a Mike Douglas show some years ago. God, I'm talking about ancient history now. I think it was done at that time out of Philadelphia. And when I went into the green room, this is precious. At least I think it is. You'll be the judge of that. There was Eartha Kitt and Pearl Bailey were both there, and they were gossiping away and having some laughs. And so I walked in, introduced myself, and we seemed to get along all right until I've forgotten how it came up, but the subject of God came up. And so I put my 2 cents worth in, and I was immediately assailed by both of them, particularly Pearl Bailey. Oh, then you're going straight to hell. I won't see you after I'm dead. Which is probably quite true anyway, but then, of all things, I hope you're ready for this, in walks Mother Teresa. She was accompanied by 2 nuns that were fullbacks, I'm sure. They actually had mustaches. They were nuns, but they had mustaches. That happens to women at certain ages of certain characteristics. I don't know anything about that, and I don't want to know anything about that. But they were rough-looking babes, let me tell you. And they walked practically touching her on each side. She took a seat at the far side of the room, didn't even look at anybody. She was a holy woman, after all. And the 2 nuns stood on either side of her, facing us. And Eartha Kitt made so bold as to go over and approach her, where she's sort of huddled over. She got a Bible in her hands. What else? In her hands, and she's sort of looking into the mirror. And Eartha Kitt wanted to introduce herself, and Mother Teresa turned and snarled at her, saying, "Can't you see I'm praying?" And Eartha Kitt sort of backed up, and she said, "Oh, excuse me." And the 2 bodyguards stepped forward and really shouldered Eartha Kitt out of the way. It was quite something to see, I'll tell you. I never got around to introduce myself to Mother Teresa. She was taken out there, and she did about 40 seconds asking for money, I think it was. And then she was escorted out of the building into a limousine that could hardly turn the corners. It was so long. that was sort of a religious cabal that was organized against me, I believe, but maybe not. Maybe it just happened that way. But Eartha Kitt and Pearl Bailey really lit in at me like crazy. Now, I wasn't terribly surprised at that, but they seemed to be very, very defensive. And I found that with most celebrities, who they're used to having their way. You know, they're used to being recognized and being given precedence in many matters, of course. And so they speak up and say their piece, which I respect. I'm all for that. But, boy, I don't find very many of them that, that will sympathize with my point of view of being, first of all, an atheist in religion and a serious skeptic of paranormal events and whatnot.
Would you say that they, as a, in your experience, they tend to be more intolerant because they're used
to... Oh, yes. Yes, well, they're used to having their way, you know. They're not used to being questioned because their fans always smother them with affection and agreement and are always nodding and smiling. So they're not used to coming up against anybody with any opinions that might differ from theirs. So I guess they're sort of, they're spoiled brats.
Well, Randy, thank you very much for that anecdote. I did, in fact, find it adorable.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake. I then challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake, and you all can play along. We have a theme this week. The theme is humor.
Oh, good. I majored in humor.
Excellent. That'll give you an unfair advantage. Everyone ready?
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
Item number one. New functional MRI study supports Freud's theory of humor as a sexual arousal relief. Item number two, researchers have built the first artificial intelligence that has a sense of humor. Item number three, psychology researchers have demonstrated that older adults do not understand jokes as well as younger adults. Rebecca, since this is your field, why don't you go first?
Damn it. I want to go with researchers building the first artificial intelligence with sense of humor because that seems so out there. But maybe that's what you want me to think.
Yeah, you're pulling a Bob.
Yep, second guess me.
I know. Well, I'm thinking that you might be... older adults not understanding jokes as well as younger adults, that seems very true because I'm picturing an elderly person saying, What are you damn kids laughing at? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. What are you laughing at over there?
Right.
Yeah, so you're basing it on a stereotype. I get it.
Yeah. Sometimes stereotypes are true, Steve. And if you don't get that, that's because you're old. but yeah, that's maybe you're just trying to throw me off. So I'm going to go with that one. Actually, I'm going to say that older adults do understand jokes, maybe better than younger adults.
Okay.
So you're going to go against what you just said.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's my usual thing because I always assume that Steve is pulling some sort of shenanigans.
Gotcha. All right, Evan.
Researchers have built the first artificial intelligence that has a sense of humor. That's not true, my friends. That one is false.
All right, Jay.
If that turns out to be the correct one, then I'm just going to point out that I almost went with that.
Yeah. I do that every week that I'm wrong.
I'm having my weekly mini panic attack because...
Oh, my God, Jay. Come light up.
Because I remember reading, I think, all three of these. But I hate you for it, Steve. And that's what makes it funny. Anything to do with Freud, I think, is bullshit, so I'm just going to pick that one.
Yavol! Okay. Bob?
That's a good point,
Jay.
Break
the tie, Bob.
That's a good point.
That's how I run my life, Bob.
There's no way I'm picking number two. So...
Bob, join me. We'll walk down this path together.
The AI with a sense of humor, I'm not going near that one. Jay, you picked the fMRI, the functional MRI.
Yeah.
You think that's fake?
I do.
I like the MRI and the older and younger adult one. Both of them, I could make arguments for both. So I don't know what to pick. Wait, let me get my coin out of this pocket. For some reason, the older and younger adult one is ringing a bell more than one. So I'm gonna go with one. I've heard lots of theories about of humor and sexual arousal relief wasn't one of them. So I'm gonna go with that.
The Freud theory being false.
Yeah,
it's fiction. Okay, so you guys were all over the board this week. Bob and Jay for Freud's theory of humor, Evan for the artificial intelligence, and Rebecca for the older adult not getting jokes. Let's start with number two. Sorry, Evan. Researchers have built the first artificial intelligence that has a sense of humor. That is science.
That's a little bit of creative wording, though, you got going on there.
Hey, here's the exact title. Now the robot with a sense of humor. I didn't say robot.
Is that from a headline writer?
That's from a headline writer.
Well, there you go.
I actually use the word robot because it really is just a computer with an artificial intelligence program in it. They're just using the word robot, because it makes good headlines.
Well, the article I read said that they understand jokes, not
they came up with a computational model for recognizing verbally expressed humor. This basically is an artificial intelligence system that can recognize jokes based on statistical language recognition techniques.
That's pretty cool.
Researcher Julia Taylor is developing this with Dr. Lawrence Maslach, who's the director of the Applied Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at Cincinnati University. So this is designed to recognize pun-style jokes.
The lowest form of jokes.
The lowest form. Well, you got to start at the bottom rung, right?
People would pun would just as soon pick
up. So what, do they fart on the robot?
Speaking as someone who writes headlines, I have to say that the pun is the greatest form of humor. If not, at least the easiest. Go on.
I have to agree with Rebecca.
I just need to stick up for puns.
Well, Asimov would disagree with you guys.
I like puns.
Yeah, but look where he is.
Seriously, like he knows anything.
But you want to hear something funny. Rebecca, do your English accent.
Oi, governor, clean your chimney.
That's an English accent, I'll give you that.
All right, let's move on to number one. New fMRI study supports Freud's theory of humor as sexual arousal relief.
Careful.
That one is complete and unadulterated
hokum
fiction. That
really?
One.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hokum. Cool. Bonk. We did it, Bob.
You know, I've only just realized that you said sexual arousal relief, right? Is it
yes.
The opposite?
No. So that is Freud's theory. Freud's theory of humor was the sexual arousal relief theory, that we laugh in situations where we are sexually aroused and then we don't have an outlet for that sexual arousal, so we relieve it through laughing. Right, that was
right.
Freud's
I'm wondering
theory.
If the fMRI proved the opposite, because laughing actually turns me on quite a bit. That's
does
all.
It? But actually, this is not based.
You're going to be getting jokes in your inbox every day.
Good.
I was lucky to find two stories about humor. I couldn't find a third one, so I just made it up completely. So there was no fMRI study, but I did read a lot about the humor theory. Actually, no one really buys Freud's theory anymore, and the most I think popular current theory is conflict resolution.
Right.
So we laugh in situations where there is some apparent contradiction or conflict, and then that contradiction is resolved. And in fact, fMRI studies of the brain have shown that when we hear a joke, that the brain goes through certain processes. First, we process the language of the joke, where we process the words. So the language center will light up first. And then that part of the brain that resolves contradictions will light up, where we try to make sense of what was said. And then the amygdala and the emotional centers of the brain then experience the emotional response of laughter or humor. But there's nothing in there that has anything to do with Freud's theory. So that one is fiction. Which means that psychology researchers have demonstrated that older adults do not understand jokes as well as younger adults is science.
That was an easy one. I mean, that one is so obvious.
And it does correlate with general cognitive decline. They did distinguish between not understanding a joke and just not thinking it's funny. The observation that older adults don't appreciate humor as much as younger adults was made previously, and the speculations were, okay, so is it that they've been there, done that, they've heard all these jokes before, they just don't find as much funny, or is it that they don't really get the jokes? And this latest study suggests that, no, they don't get the jokes. It's just a symptom of the overall cognitive decline that occurs.
Oh, it's not because they're outdated. Like, I know that there's jokes that I tell with my friends that,
yeah,
you know, an 80-year-old guy wouldn't find funny because they just don't get it because they're not culturally there.
Yeah, this study says it's not that. It's not culture. It's not experience. It's that
it's pure cognitive decline.
The abstract reasoning is slowed down a bit, so they literally don't understand the joke.
Oh, okay.
Something else to look forward to.
Well, don't worry. You always have the jerky
boys. The singularity is near, Bob. Don't worry.
Nah.
So congratulations, Bob and Jay.
Yeah, thank whatever.
Yeah.
Come on, Rebecca. Evan, let's go get a drink.
Evan, can you please tell us last week's puzzle and give us the answer?
Last week's puzzle is as such. Name the person who believed that it was his father's teachings, accompanied by study and prayer, that compelled him to dedicate his life to bringing down Darwinism, just as several of his fellows had dedicated their lives to bringing down Marxism. And the answer is Jonathan Wells.
Jonathan Wells.
Jonathan Wells is an author, prominent promoter of intelligent design, and a great opponent of evolution.
Not a shock.
He holds a PhD from University of California, Berkeley, in molecular and cell biology, mm-hmm. and a PhD in religious studies from where, Steve?
I don't know.
Yale University.
Oh.
So.
Aren't you proud?
So well,
who was his favorite winner? Wrote a book called The Icons of Evolution.
Yeah, Icons of Evolution. Religion. Yeah.
And.
Yeah, he's a loser.
Yeah.
Who was his father?
He's father Reverend Sung Young Moon, of course. of the Unification Church, the Moonies, better known as, and
that guy was a nut.
You know, birds, basically birds of a feather, flock together. In this case, one nut hanging out with the other nuts.
Did we have a winner, Evan?
And this week's winner was Orthodox Infidel from Massachusetts. Was the first one to get it right.
Hey, congratulations!
Congratulations!
Well done, Orthodox Infidel.
Evan, do we have a puzzle this week?
Yes, we do. This week's puzzle is a question. What do you call a snake handler who appears between a stinger and a shooter? So wrap your mind around that, and good luck, everyone.
I'm going to go get a shooter right now.
I'm joining you.
Perry is now joining us from his sick bed. He was so dedicated to his performing his duty as the quote master of the week that he wanted us to call him so he can give us the quote of the week. Thanks for joining us, Perry.
Perry D coming at ye with this week's quote.
Perry's obviously delirious from all the medication that he's getting.
Perry, how's it working, bro?
Perry, save some for me.
This is just for you, SGU listeners. Listen up. Go like this. Intellectual growth should commence at birth and cease only at death. That was Albert Einstein, 1870. 1955, a German-born American physicist of some. He's of some note. That's all for now. I'll see you soon. Oh, my dear friends. Bye-bye for now. Very deal. See you very soon. Hopefully on the 11th, everybody. Bye-bye.
Later, Perry.
Thank you, Perry.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Can I have some of what he's on?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah.
I'll have what he's having.
I'm still not 100% sure that was our Perry.
That was just some random guy you called.
I'm not kidding. Guys, Perry, right now, his mind is blown out with morphine or something. That was amazing.
It was a little bit more happy than Perry's usual self.
I know,
maybe
right?
He saw the whole planet Earth at once or something.
Yeah.
You're right. Maybe he did.
Oh, God.
Well, that is our show for this week. Another reminder that we have our big summer event coming up Saturday, August 11th, noon, at the Voorhees Auditorium in Brooklyn, New York.
Yep, go on the website for details on the homepage. You'll see a link there.
Yeah, and we'll be joined by Todd Robbins of Coney Island, USA. Todd was with us at TAM 5 this past January. He has a lot of fun. You never know when he's just going to like eat a light bulb or something. He's crazy.
We need those
light
bulbs.
So he'll be hanging out with
us.
Well, yeah.
Maybe he'll wait till after
the show. He'll probably find something else odd to eat. Yeah. Bring your own light bulbs. That's what I'm saying.
Thanks again, everybody.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Night, guys.
Good night, everyone.
Good show,
everybody.
Until
next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Endless delays.